Hello. But I got unmute myself. That was the other thing. So today is the 17th of January. Oop, I better turn on the video too. For the Zoom. Okay. And you guys can't see it, but I do have the Zoom. Has anybody looked at the sessions from last week? I uploaded them to the website. So if you ever miss a class or you are totally, I guess, what some more of the wonderful material, but typically I imagine if you're in class, you won't do it. So you can go to the website and go on a teach-in, and on the class website, I'm posting the audio. Oops, let me make that bigger. There's the audio recordings from the Zoom session and the video, but I need to start my recording for this one. Okay, so now I started the recording. I see there is a couple of people online. This is Tuesday, January 17th. So Tyra or Mara, can you give me a thumbs up or say hello or something to make sure that you hear me?
Hi.
Okay. Hi. Thank you, Mara, for checking this out. So you can see that the recording is on. And we are starting since I'm back in North Dakota from being in Virginia for 2+ weeks. So, any questions to begin with? I see you have a quiz that's due by the end of today, by midnight. So if you haven't done that, you have a quiz on Lucas Castro's presentation on Thursday, 5 questions. And I noticed a few people, this quiz you can take up to 3 times, and I think it takes your highest score. So if you don't get 5 out of 5, you can go back and take it again. Okay, so there is another quiz that will be on for today. And every one of these quizzes is gonna be a little bit different. So kind of like flying a little bit different airplane. Read the manual. So this one you can only take 2 times, the test that will be on the quiz for today. And instead of having it due at the end of the day, since I already posted it, well, it's posted at 5:30, it will be posted. So you can't do it during class period. Okay. And you can't do it during Thursday's class period. So you got to have it done by 4 p.m. on Thursday. This is to avoid people with their laptops doing my quizzes during the class. However, someday I might give you an in-class one too. So, but I don't know, staff or something. We'll have to make arrangements because not everybody brings their laptops. So, so do the quizzes, and that's in the syllabus, 20% body of quizzes. And I think that'll be a, and they make it harder and different. So, no problems with the Respondus lockdown browser. I'm going to do these. No problems taking a quiz. I imagine it's an old hat with this technology. It's probably my fault. I don't know if you noticed the last one. I forgot to do the lockdown Respondus browser on the quiz. So you could use any browser on that one, I guess. But the other thing is these are the types of questions that you see in the exam. So I see a few people taking notes. So all my presentations are online, so you don't have to write everything down because you see them. So what do you think I would recommend? What do you think when you're writing, taking notes for the lectures, what should you be writing down? Has anybody ever told you this? How to study, how to take notes? Anybody want to volunteer an answer?
Stuff that isn't
on the slides. Stuff that's not on the slides? Yeah, but I can get pretty comprehensive slides, but they're a little bit different. But there are a few things that are not on the slides. What should you be thinking about? So you're going to have an exam. You're going to have a quiz, right? What you should think about is what's going to be on that exam. There are going to be questions. So write down all the questions you can think of related to the slides. And so to help you with that, I write some questions in my slides. Okay, so questions about why and where are we talking about this? What is he going to ask about this? What's someone else going to ask? And the reason we ask you questions is if you go out and you fly one of these internship, people are going to come up to you and ask you, well, what are you doing in? I was at the hotel talking to the people that work at a hotel. Why are you here? You know, they ask me questions. You know, what are you doing? We're flying winter storms. You know, so you need to be able to answer these questions. You know, oh, you're doing a weather modification operations project. Oh, what are you doing? You know, what kind of material are you using? What are you? So people will ask you this. So you got to be able to answer that. So that's what you should write down, is all the questions that are in, that will be on the final exam, the quizzes, the midterm exams. And so when you think of this, write down them questions. And then of course, you got to answer them at some point. So write down the answers. And that's how you study. Forget looking at the notes, just trying to answer questions. All the other stuff is just wasting your time. So if you want to be very efficient at studying, write down questions and answer them. So so today, let's see, I put it on here. I always get my fonts messed up. I'll have to figure this out. But we're going to talk about the history of weather modification. I got a little short video and a little bit of data to show you, but basically it's the history of weather modification. Where did it start with? And I find this exciting. I love history in some ways, and I like to talk to older people in the field because they tell me about the history of what has happened, about all these people that I hear about in books and that I have done field projects and stuff and wrote papers, and I've never met them, and they tell me about them and what it's like to have worked with them. So we're going to talk about a few people with that. And let me see. Oh, this is going to be the other thing. If I can open up my file. And
Okay, it's opening it. So I have the presentations and I made them with the file extensions PDFs, so everybody can open up the PDFs. Does anybody know what the ODP extension stands for and what it is? You probably haven't seen that before. I get a couple no's. Oops, what did I do there? So I'll show you by. Yeah, I guess I got. So this is a slide, the presentation that I pulled up on the ODP file, but you've always probably heard of PowerPoint, right? That's a Microsoft product to make your presentations. That's all that you ever used. Do you know there's something else to use to make your presentations? There are other options. So one of them is called LibreOffice, an open source package, and that's what I use to make my presentations. And they use Open Document format. So there are alternatives to PowerPoint. So this is the presentation in LibreOffice. So if you care, you can open up them ODP files in PowerPoint, but they may not look quite right sometimes with the fonts and stuff. But I have LibreOffice installed on this computer, so we're all set.
Dave?
Yes.
Are you sharing your screen?
No, I am not.
Yeah.
Then why? I need you. That was the last thing on a checklist that I need to do. This is why I need someone online. I did that once. Share screen. And I got to share that screen. Okay, now. And then, so I got to share the screen, and then I also have to hide the controls. And I got to go back. And so there's the presentation tool, but I got to launch it from the other menu. So now you can see it, right, Mar?
Yes.
Okay, thank
Perfect.
You.
Thank you.
Yes, this is why I need lots of help with this. So it's kind of like your co-pilot backing up your pilot, right? Need some help. So history of weather modification. Generally, the science behind weather modifications didn't really develop until 1940s and World War II. So that's 80 years ago. Before that, there were patents related to weather modification in the 1890s, and there was some work on that, the field, but there was really no scientific basis of what they were doing it. So you can go back historically, everybody wanted to have different types of weather. So people were really interested in it, but there was really no science behind it until the 1940s. So the work was done at General Electric Research Labs in New York. So there's the example of a question, you know, when was this field started? Who started it? So we did that, one example of the early history was in 1901, they had these hail cannons. They thought big loud noises would break up hailstorms. But they had no scientific reason behind that. A lot of it is just correlations that they seem to have seen something happened. They had a loud noise and then the hail stopped. But it could have just likely due to this coincidence. And General Electric Research Lab, like I said, World War II, and they were dealing a lot with aircraft icing. So, and there's a lot of similarities between aircraft icing with the super cool droplets that were done. And additional people that worked on this, one, the famous one is Vince Schaefer, and a couple other people that were involved. You can see them looking at the propellers, because in World War II, they had the aircrafts that would encounter this icing conditions that would negatively affect them. So a lot of this was related between looking at the impacts of aircraft icing. And so we continue to do a lot of aircraft icing work. So obviously this is focused on our North Dakota Citation research aircraft. So we have this full one, the P3, and you can ice, I suppose I should point on the video with the mouse. You can ice up the probes ahead of them. So this is when you have super cooled water in the clouds, they accumulate on unheated surfaces on the aircraft. So you see here that this there's ice build up back here on the heads of the probes, they ice up. But on the tips, we have heaters. Just like on the leading edges of your aircraft, a lot of times you have heaters. So we heat these up to keep the super cold water from freezing. And so that's what they've done. And now to create what we were doing in this past weekend, we have on our NASA P3 a couple rice probes, we call them. These are Rosemont icing detector probes. So these are one of your commercial aircraft that actually provide the warnings that you're in icing conditions. And I've worked with the Rosemont group. There's a group in Minnesota that is a bunch of these engineers that have developed these aircraft probes. They were originally Rosemont, and then they were bought out. The whole group gets bought out. Right now, they're Collins Aerospace. So I've worked with them under like four different names. So every 5 years, they seem to move to a different company. So, and it's kind of hard to see, but there's one on the fuselage with this window insert, and the probes right here. This one's really hard to see. I'm sorry, it's on the side of the aircraft. But if you look right here, right above my tip, there's a little rod that sticks up. And this rod moves back and forth very quickly. Okay, so it vibrates like 40,000 times a second. Yes, very quick. And so if you have water that impacts on it, it's gonna freeze, just like on here. So that rod, because it's just given the same amount of energy to vibrate, when you have mass accumulating on that, it slows down the vibration. It gets slower and slower and slower. So that's the way to detect if you're in super cooled water, because they don't want to just measure the clouds. They want to detect if it's super cooled, if it's freezing. So again, now I'm going to break out. So we have this on the aircraft. And I'm sorry I didn't put this in my presentation, but just to show you that I have, this is a plot of the data. So last Thursday was the 17th when we met.
Let me see if I can make this on the right screen. I pulled it from the wrong screen to this one. I'm still sharing, but I have to make this bigger. On the X-axis, so the label is the 13th of January. So 01 is January 13th, 2023. And we have two of these. We have A and B. So this is a frequency. And I said 40,000. So we measure frequency in hertz. Hertz is the inverse of the number of measurements. So it's 40,000 is how many times it vibrates in 1 second. So, and then on the x-axis, we have the time, but it's basically in seconds. And in this case, we use seconds from midnight when we started a flight. I get really annoyed when we go across the time, right? We get to 24 hours, then what do you come back to? Zero. So if I plotted the data, you have part of flight and then it wrap around and start over. So this way we have a continuous data stream. It's how many seconds in an hour? 36,000, no, 3,600, 60 times 60. How many seconds are in a day? That's a harder one. 86,400. How many seconds are in a lifetime? About 2 billion. So anyway, we won't ask you them questions on the exam, but so what happens is you see like here, it's nice and even, but it starts to decrease and you can't really see it too much because it happens so quickly and we're plotting up a whole lot of data here. But basically you see it's high and then you get some of these that go down and then go back up. And by how fast it goes down and up, it relates to how severe the icing is. So this relates to weather modification because we do the same thing where we're interested in that super cooled water. Okay, so question. What is super cooled water? I think this is on your quiz. What does it mean? Well, maybe it's not. Something about related to super cooled water.
Yeah,
so below freezing. But if it's below freezing, wouldn't it have froze? So it's the thermodynamic freezing point, which means where it's energetically, it is in its lower energy state. It should freeze. That's where it likes to be, okay? Just like I like to be sleeping at 3 a.m. or 2 a.m, but I'm up flying in the airplane because I want to fly through this super cold water. It's this lower energy state. So if you can freeze it, will stay there, but it doesn't necessarily go to that lowest energy state. It's like a pebble that's on the top of a hill. If you started rolling down the hill, it keep rolling, but it may just stay up on that top. So it's below 0 Celsius, 32 Fahrenheit. And in this case, we were flying, I gotta remember, we sampled at minus 15 Celsius. We did some legs there. We did some legs at, I think, minus 4 or 5 Celsius. In both them cases, it was super cool. We had little pockets of super cool water. So the next question is, how cold can it get? I said it's easy to find super cooled water, minus 5, minus 15 even. But can you always have super cold water in the atmosphere? Get some no's. That's the right answer. So how cold can it get?
Minus 20.
Minus 20, you get super cold water.
That's right.
Minus 40, you probably not. Minus 40 is about where you should have it homogeneously freeze. So no matter what the state, it will actually get cold enough. It will not stay frozen. So if you have cold at minus 40, unless you're in a big updraft and it doesn't have a couple seconds to freeze, it probably will be frozen at minus 40. Somewhere minus 36, minus 40. So we do that. And I gotta go back through my slides. So that's the relationship between where we're interested in that super cool water. So I answered my question here in terms of how cold can super cool liquid water be? So I've been putting my questions in purple to remind me to ask you them questions. Although I didn't kind of went over it ahead of time. So there's a concept that is super cool water that's very important to aircraft icing and to weather modifications and the first experiments that they did in cold boxes. So I got a nice picture here. Can anybody describe this? What is happening? Anyone want to take a guess? So you're supposed to be able to, they describe in the caption here that these are fog streaks.
Or like clouds are freezing.
So yes, you kind of have it. This part, most of this is a cloud that has super cool droplets in it. And then you get a little bit of ice, and ice grows very big and it starts to fall. So it's like the cirrus clouds. You always see the fog streaks from the cirrus clouds. This is basically ice that is falling out of this cloud. The other stuff is smaller and it's water and it stays there. So it's super cold water. So you can observe these. And sometimes they've even done these with near airports or something when the airplane goes through. It will stimulate the formation of ice and you'll see that. So what they first did back in 1940s, so they basically took a nice big chest freezer, and we have these in our labs now, and they put in a bunch of super cool droplets. You can see from my illustration here, these little dots are supposed to be water, and let's make the temperature cold in the freezer. So it gets super cool. You could have these sort of droplets occur. And then they introduced what they call dry ice. So it's frozen carbon dioxide, very cold substance. Put it in here and there would be ice crystals that form. You get this big, larger ice that would form when they introduced the dry ice. So then you wait some time, the water droplets would disappear and ice crystals would form. And because just like them fall streaks from the clouds, the ice crystals are big and they would fall to the bottom of the chamber. Okay, so that's what they did in 1940s. So nowadays we have more sophisticated equipment. So I was did an experiment at the cloud chamber at Michigan Technological University in Northern Michigan, in Houghton. I mean, people know where that is. I have to go snowmobiling, skiing, water lake effect snow. Anyway, they have a very sophisticated cloud chamber. So basically a big, more sophisticated than an ice box. And so we did the same thing, except in
instead of injecting dry ice, we injected silver iodine or aerosols that were produced that we use for seeding the clouds. And this image here, I got my razor pointer. Oh, I knew I bought this for a reason, but my battery did. I haven't used this year. All right. Well, imagine it works. And you usually see it with a green dot on it. This is, instead of a laser pointer, it's a laser sheet. So it's a vertical sheet that's illuminated with a green laser. And what you do is you look at this from an angle through a window. So you're not looking right onto the sheet, but you're looking here, and there's a couple of tubes where we put in the silver iodine, the aerosols in here. And when we start out, we basically have a whole bunch of water droplets. And then these big, large, bright specks are the ice. Okay. So after you inject this, just like they did with the dry ice, you see these big specks that form. And you'll see that. And I have these pictures. So I'm showing you the pictures first, but this is a great time because now I have a video. We can watch some videos here. We can relax a little bit, stop taking notes. Let me see if I go and, or maybe I need to hide my screen again. What did I hide? I guess that's what I needed to do. And I think I need to, let me go back. I will pull up the video here at some point. All right, so every time I do this, I gotta hide the floating controls. So this is basically a webpage. I gave you a link to it. But we have some videos here to watch. And hopefully it doesn't get too loud. Maybe I better make sure that the volume's not up too much. And if you're bored, you should be, just go, not if you're bored, but see if I can go and show you this one. So this is a video that's about 4 minutes long. And the laser is coming from the side. So you see the bright spot here. I suppose I could make this full screen. If I knew how. Load the icon there. Made it a little bit bigger. It won't get too much. I could turn off the lights. But so basically, you see this bright spot. That's where the laser is. And then once occasionally, particularly up at top, you see the bright little specks. That's the ice. And then the little ones that are moving around here, these are the small water droplets. And this is a turbid chamber. So these small droplets are about 10 microns in size. So they're very fine. Take a human hair. It's the finest human hair you can see. That's how big these are. And so they're all moving around in this turbulence. So this is what a cloud is when you fly through it. Very small, turbulent, moving around all the time. And you see these specks are in here. And well, this one, I guess, is 12 minutes. So we could wait here forever and ever and spend time. Any questions while we watch this really interesting video?
Yes.
Can you see that? I know it's on the picture, so it's probably the direction to which the forest is at.
Well, what we're injecting them, what are small particles. So in this chamber, it basically makes a cloud. And the cloud just sits in the chamber. It doesn't move. So it's about a big meter, cubic meter volume. So if you think about how big that is, it's across this is about 3 or 4 feet in size. So it's a big cylinder. I can show you pictures of it, but it's room size type of area. So the cloud is sitting there, and it's because of the way they set up the temperatures in here, it's just turbulence, it's moving around. If you can see that there's more of them specks now, right, than flashes over time. What it is, to inject it, I guess is your question, is a quarter inch stainless steel tube that we push aerosols, particles in. And they just have to sit in the air. So that's another thing I do to the undergraduate students. Like, if I took a match and made some smoke up here, it would disperse throughout this room in a matter of a few seconds. It's very turbulent. So, and this is even, that's just in this room. So I can put an instrument in the back of the room that measures these particles. And if I write the match up here, you'll see that come up in a couple of seconds. It moves out. So that's the type of stuff we put in. It's like smoke. It's sort of small particles. So in this case, it's particles of that contain silver iodine, which nucleates the ice particles. And there's a lot of ice near the top, but there's also some ice falling off the top. And the ice kind of is heavier, so it typically falls to the bottom, even in its turbulent chamber. But you see these plumes, there's a nice sort of plume that comes up. So that's a rise in air. The air is a little bit warmer, so it rises up. You can see these nice, very small scale plumes. Typically, you think of the plumes that give you updrafts that's big enough to rift up the crowd, but there's and all types of these small scale features that occur. So the bright stuff is where you have lots of droplets that are rising and warming up. And the dark is where there's no droplets. Other questions? Then another video. Let me see if I can go back here. The side-by-side one. So this is 15 seconds of two different time periods. One, when you don't have any ice nuclei in a chamber. By the way, this is, I think I put on here, we did different temperatures. I think this is about -5, -6 Celsius on these videos, if I remember. So -5.8 Celsius. Is the temperature here inside the chamber. So now this is two videos so that you can see the difference. On the left is when you have the droplets. On the right is when you introduce the AGI particles. So you see all the ice that forms in this. So we see this in the crowd chambers. We can see this with airplanes when we fly through it at probes. And they had a big experiment with a couple years ago where they've been publishing a lot of papers where they put AGI in the clouds with an aircraft and they look at that with a radar and they can see the ice forming. So we can see it on all different scales, small meter scales. We can see it on a bigger scale with aircraft probes and we can see it on a large scale with radars. So this is what we've done since the 1940s, as we got more sophisticated from the water crowd chamber, and now we can see these effects on different scales. So go through and watch the video. I think it's just memorize interest and see how turbulent and how things move. And this is only showing you two dimensions because this is happening along the Rajah Street, in and outside of that Rajah sheet that you can't see too. So there, that was your vertebra break for this long crest period. Any questions? Let me see if I can get out of this video. Maybe. Stop. All right. I'll get back to all right, so what's it doing? I'm going to get back to my okay. Finally, they wanted me to use Microsoft Chrome. I'm going to get back to my slides. Start from current position. And let me see now, this time I can hide my computer. So that was the little side note there. So write a question, what we can see from this. So here's some more questions. So why does this matter? Spent a whole bunch of time telling you about this. Why did this happen? Could we make this work to our advantage? So this is what science is. We discover new things and then we do engineering. Can we do something with this? Is the big thing. So, yeah, we're interested in that. You know, we take these clouds like this. Can we do something, make this work to our advantage? So this question was addressed in 1946 when Vince Schaefer dropped about 1.5 kilograms of dry ice into a stratified cloud in West Virginia. So that's what they did. And then I have another question here. So here's the, I showed you the fog streaks. So here's another cloud picture. What happened here? This is, no one wants to say. So the ice formed and it fell out. And you left where there's a hole in the cloud. So the cloud formed, something caused some ice to fall, just like we do in the chamber. And then all them ice particles fall down because they're heavy. So that's what you observe. So you see these a lot of times. So I'm gonna send me a picture sometime if you see these when you, they're prevalent, they actually did a paper that there's statistically a lot more of these around airports. So airplanes go through the clouds and cause these. So that's not the only reason. So holes in the clouds appear when you put the dry ice in there. Ice falls from the base of the cloud. And this is what they observed. It fell about 600 meters below the cloud base. And then it fell into dry air and sublimated, just means it evaporated into the from the ice phase to the gas phase. So you can do this. And in the real atmosphere, that's what they proved. After they found this in a lab, they took it out and tried it in the atmosphere. So you go back to the lab. Try to figure out what is doing this, phase change, the mechanisms for this. They propose a different method to achieve the same results. And I gotta remove all my animations from this slide. So once these ice crystals grow, form, they continue to grow. So what if you had a crystal that you could introduce that was similar to ice, but would continue to grow and seed the ice crystals? So the idea was, let's find something that's similar to ice because we want to get to that ice phase. So they asked the question, are there substances that are similar in structure to ice crystals? And the answer is yes. So you remember back, you had a little bit of science class and talk about these atoms aligning in particular lattices. So the answer is yes, we can find a structure that is pretty similar to ice. And this is a material called silver iodine. So it's a compound made of two elements. So remember back, you heard of all the periodic tables and elements are on there. There's silver on there and there's iodine. You form a compound called silver iodine. And it has the same lattice structure, and the space in between the molecules is very close to that between the molecules of ice. So you can line up in ice, you have, what is ice made up of? I told you what silver is, iodine is made up of. What is ice made of? The elements. Yes. So there you go. There's two hydrogen for every one oxygen. That's right, water. So in this, the oxygens are red and the hydrogens are white, and you have this little interface between them to make a lattice. And so the lattice structures and the spacing is similar with silver iodine. So it turns out that the AGI, the silver iodine, is quite effective at nucleating, which means big fancy word for changing from water to ice, form ice crystals, and it does it at a pretty warm temperature. So minus 5 Celsius, I showed you results that work at minus 5.8. We did another one at like minus 3.8. It doesn't work very well there. So it doesn't work all the way up to the freezing point. So it helps to get these to freeze, but it still won't freeze at zero. I'm messing up on my slides. The other thing I have here is just because I showed you a nice video for on the side is the actual data from an instrument. And one of them basically measures water and one measures ice. So we can measure these, if I can find my mouse pointer. This one is showing an ice concentration here where it's green, very low, and then we get these very high peaks. And this was not the best instrument for doing this because it's all up and down. That's noise in our instrument, so we have to average. But you basically form the ice and then it falls out. And it forms the ice after we start measuring the particles, and the concentration of water also changes. So we can quantify this too with some instruments. And if you want, you can go look at the presentation we did on this. So this is the famous picture of the big three that are looking at the supercooled fog or water in the ice chamber. And you can see that there's ice at the top here, and its whiteness is the supercooled fog. And so, some summary of our results from this work, can we make it rain? So what is rain? So we got a lot of snow and the snow's on the ground here. So this is another thing I tell people that they don't. Where does it snow the most? Where do you have the heaviest snow? At what location on Earth? It's a trick question. It's not in North Dakota. It's in the tropics. But look at Philippines, India, very warm places, and you're like, I never see snow there. Well, you're at the ground. The snow's up in the atmosphere. So the ice forms, it just melts before it gets to the ground. So I didn't say where you have the most snow on the ground. I think three-dimensional. So all that precip that really pours down starts all that snow, ice crystals. So that's why we want to make this ice, because it will fall and give you rain. Can we do this? Certainly, we can change it. I hope we showed you that they could do it and they saw how to do this. They did experiments. We can do this now. We can demonstrate that we can make it precip. Precipitation is falling ice crystals, falling water. But can we make it rain cost effectively? You know, can we do this in something that's meaningful? That's a lot more difficult to do. But we want to find up a nice sort of weak link in this precipitation process of making the rain. Where's the weak? I think about this as inefficiency. If you think of a crowd or a storm, it's like a factory for making precipitation. It produces rain and snow. It produces stuff, water at the surface. Can we figure out this weak link, this way of making it more efficient? And the existence of this supercooled water in crowds is the weak link. So these crowds can persist for a long time. There's a lot of water there. It's just not falling to the ground. So we want to make that grow bigger and fall. It's the weak point of this. Is this the answer to water shortage? So we developed these seeding agents, particularly involving AGI. You can release it from the ground. You can release it from aircraft. Can it be done on a large scale? Well, let's try this. Off to the races to try to see how we do this. So that's what started from these experiments in the 1940s. And then in the 1950s, everybody started doing this. They started doing this in North Dakota in the late 50s, early 60s. So that's where the North Dakota project started. So everybody started doing it. I see crowds, let's have a business, someone pay me. In the 1950s, I guess I would say 50s, parts of the, you know, they were seeding and doing this over 10% of the United States. And, you know, you had some science basis to this, so you can talk about it in a theoretical scientific sense. You know, it had a logical experiment we based about doing this, but then, you know, what is it actually doing in the large atmosphere? Great claims were made about the effectiveness of the operation. So yeah, we can do all this stuff on a large scale. And that's what is difficult to prove. Now, it's very easy to do something in a lab under controlled environmental conditions. They had periodic seeding experiment, like Project Cirrus was one of the first ones, at General Electric Research Labs. Seeded from the ground in New Mexico on several days each week and analyzed the rainfall patterns. So just gotta be careful because we're very good at finding patterns and knowing stuff. So if I want to show you hooves, I just would seed when it would naturally rain and not seed when it wouldn't. Okay, and then you analyze the data, you see, well, it seeds when I, it rains when I seed. Okay, I've seen people do this in the modern age. Now, get a satellite data. Look at where the storms are. Put an aircraft above where it's going to rain, in front of where it's going to, and storms are going in, see the clouds, you cause that rain. You just saw it on the satellite data where the storms are. We knew it was going to rain there. So you're not necessarily causing the effect. So you got to be very careful when you do that because it's easy to predict when something is going to happen. And if I know what's going to happen, then I just say, you know, just due to my work ahead of the storms, ahead of when you're going to do that. So that's leads to some skeptics. You know, how do we know that these caused one and wouldn't naturally happen? Do we know that this was really the result of the dry ice or something different? Maybe he did something else, even in the lab experiments, that caused these. Okay. So how do you know these? You can be skeptical. So you got to be very careful. And then this is one of the famous first-time pitchers. A good stratus deck. And again, all the water is these fluffy ones around here. And the ice, the fuzzy ice particles form here. So they just went out, dumped a bunch of dry ice in here, you could form the clouds, you could form the ice particles. So so most of the skeptics, even after the first ones, believe you could change the microphysics of the clouds. Okay. So I had one person that was a scientist once, we were discussing weather modification. She said, I don't believe it. I said, well, what about, and she studied aerosols and climate change, where you put particles in the atmosphere and it can affect the precipitation. So we can pollute the atmosphere with particles, change what it happens. And she said, oh yeah, I believe that. I said, it's the same process. You know, if we're intentionally doing it or unintentionally doing it, it doesn't make a difference. If the process is the same, there's not a, you know, nature doesn't decide that you do one thing if you intend to do it and you do another thing if you don't. So then, oh, okay, yeah, I can understand that now. So that's why with weather modification, we usually talk about that as intentionally trying to do something where we have inadvertent or other modifications that are unintentional. We can have other things that people do that unintentionally causes changes in the precipitation. So what do we need? Experiments, more experiments. Everybody likes, it's like scientists, we want more data and more data and more, but more experiments. So the initial ones, we brought into questions. you know, is very proof. And so this is a picture of the crowd chamber where I've done some experiments. So this is a big box. You could kind of see the window here that we were looking through before into the laser where you can take the video so you can see the green light sheet. And this is like 10, 12 feet off the ground. The chamber is about 8 feet tall. So that is the kind of the history, and we need to demonstrate the effects very clearly and come up with this. So, and this is the word of cartoon that kind of sums up the interest of this. The interest in wet modification is soluble in water. So if you don't have a lot of precipitation, people want to do something and to have an increase. But then if you get a lot of water, people heard about the flooding in California? Anybody from California? Lots of rain maybe, right? So now you're not too interested, but when the reservoirs are at the historic low, then you're thinking, well, we need more precipitation. So, okay, well, I made it through. For time period here. I guess we typically will go to 5:15. So don't think you, I know it's a harder class to sit through. So try to put some videos in there, ask some questions. So any questions about the history? Okay. Yes. I kind of skipped. This is maybe the instead of the history, maybe kind of the beginning of it. So what happened is a lot of projects developed in the 50s. A lot of programs started in the 60s. They were big research efforts in the 1970s. A huge amount of atmospheric scientists were studying weather modifications in the 1970s. In the 1980s, it kind of started to, the research started to decline. And then it's been pretty low activity since the 1990s. For the last, let's see, this is 30 years. So there was about the 70s and 80s, maybe even the 60s. So it's almost like a climatology. It goes up, kind of starts in the 60s with some projects, really gets a lot of activities in the 70s and into the 80s. And then since the 90s, it's really declined. So there's, you know, when in the 70s, 80s, there were, 10, 20 people getting graduate degrees in it. Now there's like one or two a year. So, it's factor 10 at least declines. They had big projects with a lot of airplanes. They would buy airplanes. They were the reason for huge projects and that. So now we have, it's a lot less. There's a few other projects here and there, and people kind of did what they could with it. And there might be a resurgence because a lot of these topics go in these like 30-year cycles. So maybe now they'll come back. We got new instruments, but at some point you do what you could, and you got to wait for the technology and to develop. So there's been some, but not like it was before. The Federal Bureau of Reclamation funded a lot of that in the 1970s and 80s. They do very little now. On the federal level, there's very little federal United States research in it. Not that there's none, but it's very small. Some of the programs do their own that are operated because they want to know how well their programs are working. And there's some interest international too. So let's see. Other questions? I know this is hard. You can always come talk to me after class too. So I know this is end of the day, but we have the rooms. So do the quiz for Thursday before class. If you forget about it, come to class 5 or 10 minutes early, you can probably do it. This one's harder. It's 10 questions instead of 5. So, and you can only do it twice. So, and I don't think it tells you which answers you were wrong on, does it? I don't know. It's like the other ones. And then tell me if I actually give the wrong answer too, so I can fix it. But you might not know. Maybe I'll try to show you some answers or something. So, okay, I'll stop that, and we'll see you on Thursday. Thanks, everybody. Hey, hello.
I just wanted to apologize for being late in the class today.
Oh, I didn't even notice. So I think it says on the syllabus, if you're late, please come in late and just be quiet. And so you did that. Awesome. What's your name?
Isabella.
Isabella, okay.
Do you prefer Professor Deline?
I don't care. You can call me Dave.
Okay.
David. But if you want to, you know, say professor, the, I don't know. I kind of don't like the doctor thing. You know,
like, you like the doctor?
No, I don't. Okay. I mean, we have, actually, you know, most of the atmospheric scientists have PhDs, but some don't. So it doesn't really matter now of the education I did 20 years ago. And I can't remember, did you miss much of it? I should apologize because I came in late and I was trying to,